Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about a FinTech that actually got FDIC insured, N26 pulls out of the UK, and some really interesting economic news that's been coming up lately that might be cause for concern. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news. All right, on to our really interesting stuff going on this week. Some scary stuff, but hopefully some good news too. Right, Steve?
It's a combination of both, really. I mean, we live in a world that has its ups and downs, basically.
But yeah.
A lot
one
of really
day
good
you
stuff.
Have the coronavirus, and the next day... Actually, Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, said they were watching for effects of the coronavirus on the U.S. and the world economy, but they kept rates flat.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be one of the things that... that triggers, that puts them over the edge to a possible rate decrease for the year. So
oh,
that was
fascinating,
kind of interesting.
Yeah. It's interesting because I've been following sort of the implications of the coronavirus on supply chains for various companies that manufacture in China, but not so much on interest rates. So there's kind of a different dimension to this whole crisis or this whole issue.
Yeah. Something else I just saw was that Theranos, the founder, Elizabeth Holmes, is in court, and she's... been able to have some of the charges not dropped, but I think they're narrowing
they're
the
narrowing
focus.
They're narrowing the scope, yeah. You mean Elizabeth Holmes?
Yes, she does have a very...
She has a very distinctive voice, yeah.
Completely natural sounding deep voice.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think I've mentioned this before, but if you haven't, Bad Blood is an amazing book that kind of details the whole saga.
I just went for the podcast.
You just went for the podcast.
It was pretty interesting. Yeah, the whole thing, it's just crazy.
Yeah.
So... we've heard about fintechs coming out with their checking and savings deposits, Robinhood, without crossing all their T's and dotting their I's. But Varo actually went through and...
They've actually gone through this, yeah.
So got it done, huh?
Yeah. So Varo Money is the first fintech that I'm aware of, at least, that has been able to get FDIC insurance. So for those of you who don't know how this whole thing works, the federal deposit insurance...
Yeah, you don't just fill it on a form and then you're done?
No, that is not how they do it, no.
No, and just pay the premium?
No. So I think as a result of, I think the Great Depression is how this whole thing came about. The FDIC will essentially...
You can say that about almost anything in the financial system.
It's all because of the Great Depression, which is now about 100 years old, right? 100 and... No, 90 something.
Yeah, 90.
Soon. But basically, Varo Money can now be insured by the FDIC, which means that if you have deposits in Varo Money, you will not be, if the company happens to go under or something, the FDIC will back you up and make you whole again if they happen to lose your money, which is amazing. And this is a huge milestone for a number of reasons. This is the first really fintech that has done this.
Really? Nobody else has done
nobody
this?
Nobody else. If you think of the Simples and Chimes of the world, or even the Monzos and the other... EU-based companies, the ones that operate in the U.S. at least, they go through another party to kind of insure them. So that creates a cost for them as well to do business in the U.S.
So it hasn't been like worth the effort, maybe. They just have their partner take care of it. The bank that they work through have the insurance.
Correct.
So it's not like the funds aren't insured, but it's not been through the...
It's somebody else.
The name on the app.
They essentially outsource their compliance and their insurance to a third party.
Okay. So is it really worth it for Varo, you think, to have done this?
I think it's worth it because this puts them on the ladder to do many, many more things other than just holding deposits. So for some context, by the way, the CEO of Varo was saying that this cost them $100 million and 3 years of effort.
Wow.
Which is just amazing.
No wonder nobody else has it. So did he say why they would get some return on this?
I think the issue is that now they can become a full-fledged bank in the U.S. They can, not now, but eventually the next step will be for them to maybe offer credit cards, maybe give you a loan as well, and sort of develop more financial products, which, you know, fintechs have sort of played in a more narrow space. But now with this, the FDIC insurance and other things to come, like a banking charter at some point, they can do all these things at a national level, all 50 states, and offer a lot of other products, which I think they see as a way to growth and profitability.
So I haven't heard too much about Varo before. Are they going after the retail market?
They're going after the consumer space, yeah. Although they also do a lot of SMB stuff as well.
Okay, small, medium business kind of stuff. Correct. Okay, so right, target for FDIC type of products.
Correct, yeah.
Where that insurance would actually matter.
Huh. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, why would you do it?
Why would you, exactly, yeah.
So yeah, Varo, not a household name though, not like
not
the
yet.
Chimes and...
The Simples and the, you know, I see Monzo ads seemingly all over the place now.
Or even the wealth management types and...
Right.
Yeah, so have they been just in a certain area?
They've been basically using, I think, the Bancorp Corporation to do this and sort of more... narrow and more niche consumer finance stuff, but now I think they may go supernova on this.
Yeah, you would spend a lot on marketing now, much more than 100 million, I'm sure.
I think maybe in a year you will have heard the name Varo multiple times.
Varo.
On every bus stop in San Francisco.
You're welcome, you guys.
Yes.
Huh. Okay. So not every mobile banking offering ends up in a happy ending, does it?
No. There's an instance of maybe companies working with regulation or rather regulation helping companies like Varo. And on the flip side, some regulations or some policies actually pushing companies out. So the German neobank N26 or N26, if you want to get German about it.
Very good.
They just pulled out of the UK. So, and they're blaming Brexit for this as well. So if you are an N26 customer in the UK, they will liquidate your account, maybe send you a check, and sorry, cannot play with Brits anymore.
Really? So how much of this is an excuse to get out of the market, but then, you know, if they weren't doing very well, and how much of it is, how burdensome were these additional regulations going to be?
That is a good question. I know that they're sort of, I would say, maybe the third player behind Monzo and Revolut in the UK. But it's still a fairly sizable market with a very sort of, you know, fintech-forward population. So I can't imagine this was not probably an easy decision for them to make. But it must be the regulatory burden on them to actually get under new British law and sort of that uncertainty. Must have been tremendous for them to say, we're just going to pull out and maybe not come back into the space.
Yeah, or maybe come back much later or something.
When things are more clear.
Dust
is more settled, yeah.
Huh.
When the UK is back in the EU, maybe, in 10 years.
So we'll see. Victim of Brexit.
The first public fintech victim of Brexit, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've seen a lot of jobs moving out to Paris and
Amsterdam
Frankfurt.
And Frankfurt, yeah.
Yeah.
Which all makes sense. I think Dublin has become a bit of a fintech mini hub as well now. So, you know, you have not only companies like Stripe, but also other consumer-facing companies as well. If they are looking to set up a beachhead in Dublin as a way to enter the EU. So, yeah, we may see other companies either follow suit or just pull out altogether from the UK. And it's a shame, really, because the UK has been traditionally a very much, again, that very fintech-forward market. So, go Boris Johnson. Thanks, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, there's always going to be a hotbed of fintech innovation, but I wonder how much they can expand their success when they don't have that easy in anymore.
Yeah.
They'll be on the same footing with big American competitors and
right, who are now becoming, you know, a lot more nimble, and they can deploy more resources, and they can have all the lawyers to do all the compliance and regulatory nonsense. So yeah, it's a really tough market, I think. It's also, I think, consumer fintech as a whole is a very low margin, very competitive space.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this may be a combination of sort of competitive pressures from maybe, again, Monzo and Revolut in the UK, but also just the regulations just got way too burdensome for
maybe
them.
It's a smart move for N26 if, you know, I know they're expanding in the US.
They are.
And, you know, they don't want to spread themselves too thin when they already have, you know, the U.S. has a high regulatory burden as it is.
Makes sense. Huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's some interesting stuff going on in the American economy, which I really wanted to point out, because there's a lot of records being set, some good, some not so good, depending on how you see it. So I want to see what kind of picture this paints for you. It just got released that the U.S. now has the highest record of credit card debt that it's ever had.
I blame my wife.
Up to, she's in there too, yeah, mine too. $930 billion, which is up $46 billion just in Q4 of 2019.
I'm guessing retailers had a really good Q4 last year.
yeah, it looks like. So the profits, corporate profits are doing well, but that might be fueled by unsustainable debt growth.
So this is the highest number ever.
The highest overall number ever, yes. That's $930 billion for a credit card balance.
USA. Yeah. USA.
We're number one. We try harder.
Yep.
A lot of that is, the concern is a lot of that is younger borrowers and, the potential for delinquency. It's up to 5.32%, and that's defined as being late 90 days or longer.
It's amazing because...
Which is a pretty high number, and it's been growing, that delinquency percentage.
So that's been growing, but also I know that we've seen a rise across all segments in terms of their FICO scores. Everyone's scores, I think, is higher now, and they're even going to release a new...
New
FICO, right? So that you could either go up or go down. But this seems to be somewhat related to that issue as well. We have stricter underwriting standards, but also debt has ballooned significantly, as well as delinquency. So
there seems to be a lot of signal there. So one of the comments from one of the Fed officials was that they were trying to study how much of that is a lower credit or relaxed credit lending standards versus the economy not doing as well and people having to borrow and or get late on their payments.
Yeah, yeah. We should note here that this is sort of, it's become a trope, but really we should really disintermediate what we think of the economy and the stock market. Those two are related, not the same thing. So even though the stock market has been pretty well, it has been on a bull run for the past, 3 years or so, the economy is showing signs of maybe slowing down in terms of job creation and the rise of underemployment and gig workers and all that stuff. So there's a lot of things of concern.
Yeah, the fundamental economy is definitely drives the market and is behind it, but there's all kinds of forces going on in equity versus debt versus derivative markets,
right,
and interest rates. So it's all a very convoluted puzzle, basically.
Yep.
And so the other record that we just saw was that the stock market, all three of the major stock indices in the U.S. as of Wednesday, February 12th, hit records. So they're at their highest point ever as well. So the Dow Jones Industrials, the S&P 500, and NASDAQ all hit their highest peak.
That's amazing. So again, the stock market is killing it, but maybe your debt is not so much killing it.
Yeah, yeah. So there's something underneath there. And the other... interesting economic release that I just saw was that home prices and refinancings are surging in the U.S. So
yes,
this is a result of low interest rates.
I actually have an email in my inbox now from a broker that I may actually refinance my own house as well, because I can get a much lower rate.
Yeah, and that would be a good thing, I think.
Yeah.
As far as refinancing and saving money, maybe not as some people are doing, refinancing and pulling out a lot of cash.
Yeah, so I've actually...
So it depends on how you use the tool, right?
It depends. Apparently people are using it to maybe just lower their payments and to do other things for the house, but not so much to take equity out of the house. Like they just want to get their finances in order and their credit in order before they actually... Because they see something coming in the next year or so.
So these low rates have really driven up the home prices.
And by low, we mean mine would have been sub 3%.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah,
it's crazy low. Existing single-family homes gained 6.6% in the fourth quarter. So now the median price has hit $274,900.
That seems awful low, but I live in the Bay Area.
For national, right?
That's like a tenth of a Bay Area house.
Well, you know, some of those other markets are starting to catch up. They mentioned that the secondary markets, Trenton, New Jersey, values increased 18.2%. Boise, Idaho, 14%.
That's all the Californians going to Idaho.
And 11% up in good old Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Beautiful this time of year.
So not the bargains that they once were. They're shooting up and catching up to the bigger or more expensive markets, I should say.
To the coastal markets.
Grown up, which are growing more slowly or kind of flattening out. I was surprised to see that San Jose, California, I think has the highest, if not the highest, average home price, actually fell by 0.3%.
That's amazing. But it fell from an average of what, like 1.5 or something? So
Right. The average home price, the median home price is $1.25 million in San Jose.
Right.
So, yeah, very, very different. But all these indicators kind of paint, I'm trying to determine what kind of...
It's so much noise, right? But what's the signal?
What does this mean? These record stock markets, record debt, also record overall household debt in the U.S. as well. So, you know, this is all seems like it's leading up to something. Like you're watching the M. Night Shyamalan movie. You know there's going to be a twist
there's
here.
There's going to be something here, yeah.
And you're putting together the pieces about what all this means. And it doesn't seem like it would necessarily be great for the stock, the equity markets, which might get undercut by all this debt and kind of like the bubble popping kind of thing,
yep.
Right? There's been a very, very long economic expansion. We're in our 11th year of expansion.
Is it really 11 years? I thought it was more like 5 or 6. That's amazing.
11 years for economic growth.
Right.
Not necessarily for the stock market. And, you know, and unemployment has been staying at around a 50-year low. So the lowest in our lifetimes for unemployment, which hasn't driven up inflation and in wages on the other side of that as well. So
I think part of that is I think the rise of underemployment as well. I think many Americans are now underemployed, making less than they should be, or in jobs that maybe they should be sort of better paid for. So that can kind of explain the lack of rise in inflation as well.
Yeah, yeah. I really wanted to point out these numbers. They're very interesting. You know, the sad thing is I don't have an answer for you if you're listening to this about what all this means or you know, more importantly, you know something's up, right? But you just don't know when to do the trade.
I do have one piece of advice if you are concerned about this stuff or if this stuff is at all of interest to you. Make sure your debt house is in order.
Your debt house?
Yes.
Your house debt
have your
and
savings,
your debt.
And your just
your
everything.
Portfolio of debt.
Your portfolio of debt. Make sure that it's in order and make sure that you have enough savings to weather potentially, you know, a catastrophic failure.
So a little bit of the economic news, it's kind of creating the environment for a lot of fintechs out there.
Yeah.
All right, now it's time for our final bites, where we take a look at a number and the fascinating story behind it.
John, what is your number, buddy?
My number is 22.
22. What's 22? Ducks.
Yeah, exactly tied to what we were talking about. It's the 22nd consecutive quarter that household debt has increased in the United States.
Amazing.
So for 5.5 years, we've been piling on debt, household debt, and it's now up to another record that I'll give you, $14.15 trillion.
So is credit card debt a subset of the household debt, I'm assuming?
Yeah, household debt is overall.
So this is student debt, mortgages, credit cards, that Macy's card from a couple of years ago, all that stuff.
Yeah, everything's in there. So mortgage is 9.56 trillion of that. And that went up by $120 billion in Q4, which is you know, another sign that maybe things are getting a little bit frothy.
Yeah.
So 22 consecutive quarters of debt growth for the U.S. So
amazing. Yeah. USA.
We'd like to see that 22 consecutive quarter of savings savings rate increases.
I think, yeah. That's,
but
that's,
knowing the American consumer.
That's a pipe dream. Yeah.
All right. So what's your number, Steve?
So my number is actually very much related. My number is $207 billion.
Yeah, is that how much more debt we're going to pile on this next year?
No, it's actually quite the opposite. That is how much the Congressional Budget Office estimates that the U.S. could forgive in student debt in the next 10 years.
Wow, we're going to need a lot of debt forgiveness.
I think we will, yeah. So there's only
work down that $14
trillion. Well, yeah, it's a small fraction, but I think we're making some progress. So there are all these programs that you can do if you go to grad school. Say if you work, you know, as a teacher, if you work for a nonprofit, you can essentially have your loan or your debt rather repaid or forgiven if you work in a public sector or a nonprofit sector. So if you add up all those people who are going through that process and, you know, who put in their 10 years of debt payments to get the remainder forgiven, that number would again total over $200 billion, which is pretty amazing. Although I've also saw in the news today that despite sort of these projections, the new budget that President Trump proposed, I believe this week, would cut that debt forgiveness program significantly. So we may see a reduction in this number as well.
I'm sure Betsy DeVos would like to cut it down to
the one pushing for that.
$2.7 billion.
Yeah.
$207 billion.
It's funny because the photo that they had in the journal article about this piece was with both Trump and DeVos.
So, right. Okay.
So yeah she is the one I think who's saying we shouldn't forgive that much debt for our students. Come on.
Yeah.
Lenders need to be paid. Come on, Sally Mae.
She's the education secretary.
She is.
And she's very much anti-education and anti-student. I don't think that's very controversial. I think the policies are very clear.
She's very much, she's pro, school vouchers and pull yourself by your own bootstraps kind of stuff and all that. So
corporations, profits, private entities, that sort of thing.
Par for the course.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I'm glad I'm past my student lending days. I'm past
same.
And getting educated. So.
Yes.
I think that's obvious.
Yep.
All right. That's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest news. And thanks for listening.
Stay debt-free.